Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. I ended the last show by talking about the M3, which has increased by 100% or more every 14 years since the Federal Reserve first started tracking it in 1959. According to a Fed table titled M3 Money Stock, M3 was about $300 billion in 1959. In 1973, 14 years later, it had grown to $900 billion. In 1987, 14 years after that, it was $3,500 billion. And in 2001, 14 years after that, it was $7,200 billion. To meet the huge interest burden required to service all this money built on debt, the money supply must continually expand. And for that to happen, borrowers must continually go deeper into debt. Merchants must continually raise their prices, and the odd men out in the banker's game of musical chairs must continue to lose their property to the banks. Wars, competition, and strife are the inevitable results of this scarcity-driven system. The obvious solution is to eliminate the parasitic banking scheme that is feeding on the world's prosperity. But how? The witches of Wall Street are not likely to release their vice-like grip without some sort of revolution, and a violent revolution would probably fail because The world's most feared military machine is already in the hands of the money cartel. Violent revolution would just furnish them with an excuse to test their equipment. The first American Revolution was fought before tasers, lasers, tear gas, armored tanks, and depleted uranium weapons. We're in a different situation now. Fortunately or unfortunately, in the eye of today's economic cyclone, we have to do no more than wait and watch as the global pyramid scheme collapses of its own weight. In the end, what is likely to bring the House of Cards down is that the robber barons have lost control of the propaganda machine. Their intellectual foe is the internet, that last bastion of free speech, where even the common blogger can find a voice. As President John Adams is quoted as saying of the revolution of his day, quote, "The revolution was effected before the war commenced. The revolution was in the hearts and minds of the people. This radical change in the principles, opinions, sentiments, and affections of the people was the real American Revolution," end quote. Today, the corporate media are gradually losing control of public opinion, but the money machine remains shrouded in mystery, largely because the subject is so complex and forbidding. Richard Russell is a respected financial analyst who has been publishing the Dow Theory Letter for over half a century. He observes, quote, "The creation of money is a total mystery to probably 99% of the U.S. population, and that most definitely includes the Congress and the Senate. The takeover of U.S. money creation by the Fed is one of the most mysterious and ominous acts in U.S. history. The legality of the Federal Reserve has never been tried before the U.S. Supreme Court," end quote. We the people could try bringing suit before the Supreme Court, but the courts, like the major media, are now largely under the spell of the financial corporate cartel. There are honest and committed judges, congresspersons, and reporters who could be approached, but to make a real impact will take a vigorous movement from an awakened and aroused populace, ready to be heard and make a difference, a popular force too strong to be ignored. When a certain critical mass of people has awakened, the curtain can be thrown aside and the wizard's hand can be exposed. But before we can build a movement, we need to be ready with an action plan, an arc that will keep us afloat when the flood hits. What sort of arc might this be? We'll begin by looking at a number of alternative models that have been developed around the world. So first, one interesting experiment in alternative financing was reported in the October 7, 2000 Wall Street Journal. It was the brainchild of Professor Giacinto Oriti, a wealthy local academic in Guardiadrelli, Italy. According to the journal, quote, "Professor Oriti hopes to convince the world that central bankers are the biggest con artists in modern history. His main thesis, for centuries, central banks have been robbing the common man by the way they put new money in circulation. Rather than divide the new cash among the people, they lend it through the banking system at interest. This practice, he argues, makes the central banks the money's owners and makes everyone else their debtors. He goes on to conclude that this debt-based money has roughly half the purchasing power it would have if it were issued directly to the populace free," close quote. To prove his thesis, Professor Oriti printed up and issued his own debt-free bills called CIMEC. He agreed to trade CIMEC for lire and to redeem each CIMEC for 2 lire from local merchants. The result, quote, "Armed with their CIMEC, the townsfolk, and later their neighbors elsewhere in central Italy's Abruzzo region, stormed participating stores to snap up smoked bruschetto, designer shoes, and other goods at half the lira price." At first, people thought, "This can't be true. There must be a ripoff hidden somewhere," says Antonella Di Cocco, a guide at a local museum. But once people realized that the shopkeepers were the only ones taking the risk, They just ran to buy all these extravagant things they never really needed. Often, they raided their savings accounts in the process. The participating shopkeepers, some of whom barely eked out a living before the Simek bonanza, couldn't have been happier. Every day was Christmas. Pietro Ricci calls from behind the counter of his cavernous haberdashery. Neither Mr. Ricci nor his fellow merchants were stuck with their simic for long. Once a week, they turned them into Professor Oruti, recouping the full price of their goods. "We double the money in people's pockets, injecting blood into a lifeless body," says Professor Oruti. "People were so happy, they thought they were dreaming." Non-participating stores, meanwhile, remained empty week after week. By mid-August, says the professor, a total of about 2.5 billion simic had circulated. End quote. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. The professor had primed the pump by doubling the town's money supply. As a result, goods that had been sitting on the shelves for lack of purchasing power started to move. The professor himself lost money on the deal, since he was redeeming the simic at twice what he had charged for them, but the local merchants liked the result so much that they eventually took over the project. When there were enough simic in circulation for the system to work without new money, the professor was relieved of having to put his own money into the venture. The obvious limitation of his system is that it requires a wealthy local benefactor to get it going. Ideally, the benefactor would be the government itself, issuing permanent money in the form of the national currency. Now, at the other extreme are people concerned with the soundness of the national currency, who favor trading in privately issued precious metal coins. Private silver and gold exchanges go back for centuries. The U.S. dollar is defined in the Constitution in terms of silver, and at one time people could bring their own silver to the mint to be turned into coins. In 1998, a private nonprofit organization called NORFED, the National Organization for the Repeal of the Federal Reserve Act and the Internal Revenue Code, began issuing a currency called the Liberty Dollar, which was backed by gold and silver. Liberty dollars took the form of minted metal pieces, gold and silver certificates, and electronic currency. Legally, said NORFED's website, the Liberty Dollar certificates were receipts guaranteeing that the holder had ownership of a certain amount of silver or gold stored in a warehouse in Coeur d'Alene, Iowa. The silver was insured and audited monthly, and the certificates were reported to be more difficult to counterfeit even than Federal Reserve notes. Liberty dollars were marketed at a discount and were exchanged at participating neighborhood stores dollar for dollar with U.S. dollars. The silver that backed the NORFED certificates, however, was only about half the face value of the certificates, depending on the variable silver market. The difference went to NORFED for its costs and to support its efforts to have the Federal Reserve and federal income tax abolished. By 2006, NORFED claimed a circulation of $20 million, making the Liberty Dollar the second most popular American currency after Federal Reserve notes. That was true until September of 2006, when a spokesman for the U.S. Mint declared the coins to be illegal because they could be confused with U.S. coins. "The United States Mint is the only entity that can produce coins," said the spokesman. In November 2007, the Liberty Dollar offices were raided by the FBI and the U.S. Secret Service. The company's owner sent an email to supporters saying that the FBI had taken not only all the gold, silver, and platinum, but almost 2 tons of Ron Paul dollars, commemorative coins stamped with the likeness of presidential candidate Ron Paul, a Republican from Texas, the fearless champion of the money reform camp seeking to return to sound money. The FBI also seized computers and files and froze the Liberty Dollar bank accounts. The seizure warrant stated that it was issued for counterfeiting, money laundering, mail fraud, wire fraud, and conspiracy. That unsettling development underscores one of the hazards of alternative currencies. Their legal standing can be challenged. Even if it isn't, privately issued money may be refused by merchants and by banks. In an effort to remedy the legal problem, in December 2007, Ron Paul introduced the Free Competition in Currency Act, a bill seeking to legalize the use of currencies that compete with the Federal Reserve's United States dollar. Paul said, quote, "One particular egregious recent example is that the Liberty Dollar, in which federal agents seized millions of dollars worth of private currency held by a private mint on behalf of thousands of people across the country. We stand on the precipice of an unprecedented monetary collapse, and as a result, many people have begun to look for alternatives to the dollar. I believe that the American people should be free to choose the type of currency they prefer to use. The ability of consumers to adopt alternative currencies can help to keep the government and the Federal Reserve honest, as the threat that further inflation will cause more and more people to opt out of using the dollar may restrain the government from debasing the currency." End quote. Legal issues aside, however, Liberty Dollar certificates have been criticized as involving a substantial markup, making them worth quite a bit less than their face value in precious metal. This is also a problem inherent in precious metal coins. The value stamped on the coins must be significantly higher than the metal is worth, just to keep them from being smelted for their metal content whenever the metal's market value goes up. But the dilution in the value of the currency would seem to defeat the purpose of holding precious metals, which is to preserve value. To remedy that problem, it has been proposed that coins could be stamped not with the face value, but just with their precious metal weight. The value would then be determined according to the spot market for the metal. That solution, however, poses another set of problems. Shopkeepers accepting the coins would have to keep checking the internet to determine their value. Another obvious downside of precious metal coins is that they are cumbersome to carry and to trade, particularly for large transactions. Gold Money and eGold are online precious metal exchanges that address that problem by providing a convenient way to own and transfer gold without actually dealing with the physical metal. According to the Gold Money website, when you buy gold grams, you own pure gold in a secure vault in London. Gold Money can be used as currency by clicking gold grams online from one account to another. Online gold is a hassle-free way to invest in gold, but it too has drawbacks as a currency. It involves a certain markup, and its value fluctuates with the volatile gold market. People on fixed incomes with fixed rents generally prefer not to gamble. They like to know exactly what they have in the bank. Gold and silver are excellent ways to store value, but you don't actually need to use them as a medium of exchange. You can just buy bullion or coins and keep them in a safe place. The gold versus fiat question will be explored later on. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you're listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And a third innovation in the local financing is the community-owned bank. Desperately poor people may be kept that way because they lack the collateral to qualify for loans from private corporate banks. Nobel laureate Muhammad Yunus designed the Grameen, or Village Bank, of Bangladesh so that ownership and control remain in the hands of the borrowers. As soon as a borrower accumulates significant savings, she buys one, and only one, share in the bank for the very modest sum of $3. According to the bank's website, 92% of the bank is now owned by its borrowers, mostly women, with the Bangladesh government owning the rest. The interest rate for loans is set so that after paying expenses, the bank makes a modest profit, which is returned to the shareholder borrowers in the form of dividends. The bank's website reports that 54% of its borrowers have crossed the poverty line and another 27% are very close to it, beginning with loans as little as $50. By August 2006, the bank had served 5 million borrowers over a period of 25 years. The Grameen Bank has asserted its independence from the private corporate banking system by providing loans to people who would otherwise be considered bad credit risks, but the currency it lends is still the national currency, issued by the government and controlled by big corporate banks. Other community models operate independently of the big banks, precious metals, and the government. So that leads us to the concept of the community currency movement, which is an attempt to sidestep the debt web with parallel currencies. Quote from Sheldon Emery in the book Billions for Bankers, Debts for the People. He says, quote, "It is as ridiculous for a nation to say to its citizens, you must consume less because we are short of money, as it would be for an airline to say, our planes are flying, but we cannot take you because we are short of tickets." End of quote. Money is a token representing value. A monetary system is a contractual agreement made among a group of people to accept those tokens at an agreed upon value in trade. The ideal group for this contractual agreement is the larger community called a nation. But if that larger group can't be brought to the task, any smaller group can enter into an agreement, get together, and trade. Historically, community currencies have arisen spontaneously when national currencies were scarce or unattainable. When the German mark became worthless during the Weimar hyperinflation of the 1920s, many German cities began issuing their own currencies. Hundreds of communities in the United States, Canada, and Europe did the same thing during the Great Depression when unemployment was so high that people had trouble acquiring dollars. People lacked money but had skills, and there was plenty of work to be done. Complementary local currencies quietly coexisted along with the official government money, increasing liquidity and facilitating trade. Like the medieval tally, these currencies were simply credits attesting that goods or services had been received, entitling the bearer to trade the credit for an equivalent value in goods or services in the local market. Community currencies now operate legally in more than 35 countries, and there are over 4,000 local exchange programs worldwide. Local or private exchange systems come in a variety of forms. Besides private gold and silver exchanges, they include local paper money, computerized systems of credits and debits, systems for bartering labor, and systems for trading local agricultural products. What distinguishes them from most national currencies is that they are not created as a debt to private banks, and they don't get siphoned off from the community to distant banks in the form of interest. They stay in town, stimulating local productivity. Local currencies can prime the pump with new money, funding local projects without adding to the community debt. Many governments actively support them, and others give unofficial support. Experience shows that these additions to the money supply strengthen rather than threaten national financial stability. Besides their monetary functions, local exchange systems have served to bring communities together, funding cooperative business where members can sell goods, new skills can be learned, and public markets can be held. So let's look at an example of this, the example of Argentina, which is creative responses to disaster. In 1995, Argentina went bankrupt. The government had adopted all the policies mandated by the International Monetary Fund, including privatization, the sale of public assets to private corporations, and pegging the Argentine peso to the U.S. dollar. The result was an overvalued peso, massive economic contraction, and collapse of the financial system. People rushed to their banks to withdraw their life savings, only to be told that the banks had permanently closed. Lawns soon turned into vegetable gardens, and local systems sprang up for bartering goods. One environmental group held a massive yard sale where people brought what they had to sell and received tickets representing money in exchange. The tickets were then used to barter the purchase of other goods. This system of paper receipts for goods and services developed into the Global Exchange Network, which went on to become the largest national community currency network in the world. The model spread throughout Central and South America, growing to 7 million members and a circulation valued at millions of U.S. dollars per year. Other financial innovations were devised in Argentina at the local provincial government level. Provinces short of the national currency resorted to issuing their own. They paid their employees with paper receipts called debt-canceling bonds that were in currency units equivalent to the Argentine peso. They could be called negotiable bonds, bonds that are legally transferable and negotiable as currency, except that they did not pay interest. They were closer to the non-interest-bearing bonds proposed by Jacob Coxey in the 1890s for funding state and local projects. The bonds canceled the province's debt to their employees and could be spent in the community. The Argentine provinces had actually monetized their debts, turning their bonds or IOUs into legal tender. Studies showed that in provinces in which the national money supply was supplemented with local currencies, prices not only did not rise, but actually declined compared to other Argentine provinces. Local exchange systems allowed goods and services to be traded that would not otherwise have been on the market, causing supply and demand to increase together. The system has some flaws, including the lack of adequate controls against counterfeiting, which allowed large amounts of inventory to be stolen with counterfeit scrip. By the summer of 2002, the RGT had shrunk to 70,000 members, but it still remains a remarkable testament to what can be done at a grassroots level when neighbors get together to trade with their own locally grown currency. Alternate paper currencies also existed in the United States. More than 30 local paper currencies are now available in North America. One has been particularly successful, the Ithaca Hour, originated by Paul Glover in Ithaca, New York. The hour is paper script that reads on the back, quote, "This is money. This note entitles the bearer to receive 1 hour of labor or its negotiated value in goods and services. Please accept it, then spend it." Ithaca Hours stimulate local business by recycling our wealth locally, and they help fund new job creation. Ithaca Hours are backed by real capital, our skills, our muscles, our tools, forests, fields, and rivers. Close quote. One Ithaca Hour is considered to be the equivalent of $10, the average hourly wage in the area. More highly skilled services are negotiated in multiples of hours. A directory is published every couple of months that lists the goods and services people in the community are willing to trade for hours, and there is an hour bank. And we will continue in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.